The third speaker in this session is Charles Islin, who's going to talk with us about the Roy Eldridge Collection, which, judging by his abstract, involved quite a lot of interesting salvage work. And we should all be quite thankful for Charles' work in that regard. Charles Islin is a recent graduate of Columbia University in the city of New York and a jazz programmer at the university's radio station, WKCR. An amateur jazz scholar, Charles has been awarded Jazz at Lincoln Center's Jazz 301 certificate and has done archival work on several sound collections of notable jazz figures, such as Roy Eldridge, who we'll hear about today, and Herman Chittison. Here's Charles Islin.
Thank you. Just going to start off by saying that I have about 10 minutes left to deliver a 20-minute presentation, so I won't be offended if anyone walks out partway through. So my presentation today is on the Roy Eldridge Collection, and I've subtitled it Submergence and Reemergence of the Music of Little Jazz, for reasons which will soon become obvious. By now, you've probably all heard, at least in passing, of this great jazz trumpeter from Pittsburgh, Roy Eldridge, nicknamed Little Jazz. But today I'm actually not going to be talking so much about the Pittsburgh side of Roy Eldridge's story, or even about Roy Eldridge himself, but more about Roy Eldridge's collection of music and the unusual task that radio station WKCR had in trying to save this collection of music in the fall of 2012. In terms of what I hope you'll get out of this presentation, maybe a bit more exposure to this often overlooked master of music, but I'd also like to encourage you to think about some of the unusual situations and challenges that might arise in some of the archival restoration and transfer work which many of us at ARSC deal with on a daily basis. So Roy Eldridge, he's nicknamed Little Jazz because of his short height, was one of the most important trumpeters in the history of jazz. He pioneered a new rhythmic sensibility and redefined how we think about his instrument, the trumpet, as well as the music as a whole. He was a great musical genius in his own right. He had a complete mastery of swing and was able to outplay just about anyone when challenged, partly through his great control of the trumpet's high notes. Eldridge was also extremely important in the development of jazz as the great Dizzy Gillespie, who developed one of the developers of the bebop idiom, started his career out learning Roy Eldridge's solos note for note. He was himself a Roy Eldridge man. Eldridge was born in Pittsburgh on the north side near the Pennsylvania Railroad workshops on January 30th of 1911. He learned music in Pittsburgh partly through his brother Joe Eldridge, elder brother, partly through listening to records and from hearing local music and bigger names passing through town such as Benny Carter and Rex Stewart. Roy eventually hit it big in New York City when he joined the Teddy Hill Orchestra. He then moved on to Fletcher Henderson, led his own band at the Three Deuces Club in the late 30s. He joined Gene Krupa's orchestra in 1941 and was eventually with Artie Shaw in 1944. He was part of some of the original Jazz of the Philharmonic concerts and had a long career as a jazz musician for the next about 40 years of his life, active mostly in the New York City area. So let's start off with a bit of a musical taste of what Roy Eldridge is about by listening to one of the unissued items from this collection. This is an air check of one of Roy Eldridge's first performances with the Gene Krupa Orchestra from May of 1941. And I apologize in advance for the poor sound quality on this, but the music more than makes up for it. So if we could go to track one now, please.
What will they ever want me, green eyes, make my dream come true? Thank you.
That was Roy Eldridge with the Gene Krupa Orchestra. One of the first broadcasts of Roy Eldridge of the band, earlier in that recording, you can actually hear the announcer say that he is the newest member of the Gene Krupa Orchestra. It's from May of 1941. And you can see Roy Eldridge with Gene Krupa there. We've heard a bit from Gene Krupa in this year's Ask presentation. So Roy Eldridge, he lived a relatively long life. He passed away in 1989. And after a series of events, all of his belongings passed into the possession of an antiques dealer by the name of Kurt Schenek, based in New York City, in 2009. They were thought to have all been destroyed, and from this point on, they remained in Mr. Schenek's basement, basically unknown, for about 3 years until late October of 2012, when larger scale events led to their little emergence from Mr. Schenek's basement. So on October 28th of 2012, Hurricane Sandy hit the greater New York area, causing widespread damage, flooding, power outages, shutting down large parts of the city. One of the biggest causes of damage was the storm surge, which flooded large parts of Brooklyn. Mr. Schenek's home was and is actually still on the Rockaways, which is this thin strip of land between the open Atlantic Ocean and Brooklyn, which was completely flooded in the hurricane. It saw more than 4 feet of water basically everywhere. It was basically under the Atlantic Ocean. Sandbagging efforts turned out to be futile, and Mr. Schenek's home was flooded, the basement and the ground floor. This is what the damage looked like after the flooding. And Roy Eldridge's possessions, which were in the basement at the time, were completely soaked. And you can see here what Roy Eldridge's collection looked like the day after the hurricane. There's his trunk and boxes of his affairs just all over the place. Here's some more pictures of the damage. Roy Eldridge's trunk, you can see his nickname Little Jazz on that. So WKCR, which for those of you who don't know is the radio station at Columbia University, was put in touch with Mr. Schenek through a volunteer photographer who had gone out to the Far Rockaways to help with the recovery effort, who knew about WKCR's involvement with the music of Roy Eldridge. And so a contingent of volunteer station members was assembled. Somehow a rental car was found a week after Hurricane Sandy. And we headed out to Mr. Schenek's house in the Far Rockaway and picked up all of the Roy Eldridge collection, about 15 crates worth. An impromptu agreement was made up that WKCR could make audio and visual copies of all the material in the collection in exchange for trying to save as much of it as possible before returning it to Mr. Schenek when his home was in a better state. Now, in terms of what was in the collection, basically anything you could imagine. Roy Eldridge didn't really throw anything out for the last 30 years of his life. In the collection, we found a large number of photographs, a few of which you've seen in the presentation, many, many documents, contracts, things like canceled checks, receipts, awards, his trumpets, his drum set, 50 pages of his unfinished autobiography, his record collection, and most interestingly for our purposes, a collection of dozens of reel-to-reel tapes and about 300 acetate discs of all different types, some of which you can see here. Now, once WKCR got hold of these materials, it was decided that we needed to save as much of it as possible. The collection was in a bad state. And we decided that we should make scans of all the visual materials and audio copies of all the audio materials, which meant all the unissued tapes and discs. For the photos and documents, the biggest problem was actually finding enough surface space in the station to lay everything out to dry properly, because there were hundreds of papers. But eventually, we got most of the things dry, and everything ended up being in a scannable state, although some of the photos ended up somewhat pickled. The record collection, the LPs did the worst. Most of those were completely warped by the water, and so those were all thrown out. But the 78 survived pretty well. They were basically just wiped down with clean water wiped and left to dry. The reel-to-reel tapes did surprisingly well from the flooding. The cardboard reel boxes actually absorbed a lot of the water and grime, and the tight packing of the tape meant that the water didn't really deteriorate the inside of the tape, so mostly the edges just got dirty. So during the transfers, the main difference was that we had to clean the tape head more than usual because of the accumulation of muck. Now, the acetate discs, the lacquer discs, were the biggest challenge. There was the simple problem that the water had caused many of the labels to deteriorate and come off the discs, and a lot of the ink to just soak off, so there was no way of knowing what was on a lot of these already badly labeled discs. The bigger issue, though, was a structural one. As many of you know, these instantaneous acetate discs, what are called acetate discs, they're actually lacquer, made of a solid core on the inside, covered by softer lacquer compound, which is what the groove is cut into, and the inner core is made out of usually aluminum, although it's sometimes either cardboard, steel, or glass. Getting water on acetate discs is a bad idea. Thankfully, Eldred had no glass core discs, as those rarely survive this kind of rough treatment. He had a lot of cardboard core discs, which actually survived pretty well, considering the circumstances. The cardboard core absorbed a lot of water, and instead of the disc breaking apart, they became pliable and soggy, so all we had to do was flatten them out and dry them flat. But those remained playable mostly for later dubbing sessions. Now, the biggest challenge were these metal core discs, one of which you can see here. Interestingly, the aluminum core discs actually made it through pretty well. For most of those, we just had to wipe down the grime off the top of the disc and then play them through. It was these steel core discs that really suffered. Now, all these metal core discs are subject to natural deterioration, regardless of what water you put on them, where sort of cracks form in the surface of the lacquer compound naturally. If water gets between these cracks, it gets under the lacquer compound and causes the bond between the lacquer compound and the steel core to deteriorate, essentially making the lacquer just flake off. The disc becomes completely unplayable. It turns out that if the water in question is salt water, the process is even faster. The motto is, as it dries, it dies. So our first goal was that all these steel core salt water discs had to be transferred before they dried out, as the drying process is the process which renders the discs unplayable. They'd essentially been living in salt water for the week before we got them. They'd been packed tightly, but they were still soaked in the water. When we got them, we peeled away the sleeves, discarded those, then we wiped down the surfaces, and we learned the hard way that if we just left them untouched from there, the delamination and shrinking process started about immediately. And the surface of the record started to look like this sort of kale chip dish, which you can see here. So with the drying and flaking, we determined that we had a window of about 5 to 8 minutes of playability while the disc was deteriorating in real time. WKCR's limited apparatus, certainly not cut out for this kind of work, but with basically only time for one play per side, considerations like setting pitch, choosing the needles, getting the EQ right, all those things were out the window. We had one guide needle drop to determine the speed of the record, somewhere between fast and slow. And in terms of setup, the goal was trying to facilitate a continuous pass through the disc. So first we wiped off as much of the dirt as possible, trying to get whatever part of the sleeves had stuck onto the record off. Then it was a matter of keeping the record wet while the transfer happened. So for the transfer, we used a Stanton 70 RPM needle, which had to be cleaned after every pass and which was completely destroyed in this process. During the transfer, the person doing the transfer on the turntable, they were holding the right arm, the right hand over the tone arm, ready to grab it in case it jumped when it hit the cracks, because we wanted to get one continuous play and we didn't have time to go through more than once, while the left hand was holding a wet paper towel over the inner grooves of the record, trying to keep those wet while the outer grooves were being dubbed so that they wouldn't deteriorate before we got to them. It was a mess. So these rusty metal discs, they were basically the subject of this emergency transfer session. We were trying to grab whatever was audible right away based on the assumption that none of it would ever be heard again. Something like this, even Irene wouldn't be able to deal with. sort of, to employ a metaphor, what we were doing was really more of a combat medic's job than a hospital doctor's job. We were using limited tools to save whatever we could save in limited time from these mangled victims. And it was certainly an imperfect methodology. We accept that. There are many ways in which the process could have been improved. The uniqueness of the situation was that this was, in the moment, the only way that we could save this music. WKCR's mostly unskilled volunteer student staff, limited money, limited time, limited space, equipment made for broadcasting. That was the best that could be mustered in the moment. And we estimated that about 25% of these steel core discs were saved in the end. Other than transferring these acetate discs, what WKCR did was to scan all the documents and photos. We dubbed all the reel-to-reel tapes. We made dubs of all the discs that hadn't been in immediate danger when the collection was found. We did those dubs using the Simon York turntable, which we were able to set up eventually. And we cleaned up as much of Roy Eldridge's possessions as we could, and all that took about a year before the collection was returned to Mr. Schneck, the antiques dealer, in the fall of 2013. Now, in terms of what music was found in the collection, a few highlights that could be mentioned are the following. Previously unheard version of Coleman Hawkins' Body and Soul, broadcast from the Duke Ellington, Lionel Hampton, and Teddy Wilson bands from the 1940s. Unissued Jazz of the Philharmonic concert. A huge number of broadcasts of Gene Krupa Orchestra featuring Roy, as the one you just heard. Several hundred hours of Roy Eldridge's club dates and broadcasts from the later part of his career. And hours of fascinating recordings of Roy Eldridge at home, Roy Eldridge practicing, Roy Eldridge home rehearsals, and even Roy Eldridge attempting free jazz improvisation on the trumpet. Perhaps the greatest discovery was a set of three test pressings, one of which you can see here, of alternate takes from Eldridge's first issued record date as a leader, done in January of 1937 for the Vocalion label. These recordings had remained unheard by anyone but Eldridge since 1937, and they were not thought to exist by anyone at all until we found them. So let's hear Eldridge's solo on one of these to close off today's presentation. This is on Eldridge's Powerhouse presentation, After You've Gone. So we could go to track two now. That'd be great.
After you've gone away.
After You've Gone, one of the highlights of the collection. If any of you are interested, the entire collection ended up being purchased in its entirety by the Sherman Jazz Museum in Sherman, Texas. It's about an hour north from Houston. If any of you are in the area, I'd highly encourage going to see the collection. They've done a really good job there of putting everything on display, a lot of the Roy Eldridge's memorabilia. They have all of his awards, his instruments, and posters. So we probably don't have time for questions, but if any of you do have questions about the music or the collection, I'd be happy to answer them. And other than that, I'd like to thank you for listening, and enjoy the break.